Welcome to the Immigration Tales podcast, where people from all over the world share their migration stories through narratives and interviews. Here is your host, Victor Cajal.
Tonight's guest, Fred from Mexico. Folks, my guest this evening contacted me saying he wanted to be part of the show, and you guys know I love when that happens, and I want more of you to do that because I've been getting emails about not frequent enough shows. Frankly, I've been having a little bit of a hard time. So if you know some friends that have unique stories, you know, like Fred's going to have today, contact me over at immigrationtales@gmail.com and be a part of the show. Help grow the community of Immigration Tales because everyone has an immigration story. My guest tonight is Fred Castaneda from Austin, Texas, via Mexico. Fred, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Victor. And it's Castañeda. The ñ, of course, on the code page for the keyboard is something that isn't included unless you got the Spanish national language, but it's Castañeda, right?
That's a very good correction there, Castañeda, absolutely. And, Fred is also a podcast. You can probably tell by his voice, and I was lucky enough to get a chance to listen to parts of a couple of his episodes. He does a podcast called Arriba, Folklore Music and Dance of Mexico, and wow, really a neat concept for a podcast, Fred. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that before we get going with the story?
Oh, well, when I wanted to get into podcasting, Victor, I decided that the first thing I wanted to do is learn about it, and what better way to do it than do podcast for passion? I mean, you did it with your, you know, typical PC user podcast, typical Mac user podcast, and I think this is an extension of your passion. So I used to be a folklorico teacher, an instructor of folklorico dance from Mexico at the University of Loyola in Los Angeles, and I was also a professional dancer for a short while with a couple of groups, Floricanto, and was admitted into Mexicapan, but I really didn't want to do the professional scene. I enjoyed just leading the groups there at the university. And so when I went into podcasting, I said, I used to teach this course. I taught a three-unit course, which was the history of folklorico music and dance. It was a humanities course, three units at the university, and I taught it for several years, and also taught a one-unit practical application. That's when I took people of all levels to teach them to dance three folklorico dances of Mexico and then perform in a gala event at the end of the year. So because I had written the book, there were no books. I wrote my own book for the course, and I had a lot of experience and a lot of, shall we say, connections, and a lot of networking, so I knew the folklorico instructors and the mariachis and the conjuntos everywhere. So I said, why don't we do a podcast on folklorico music and dance? There was none out there. And I did, and I launched it last year. And the reason I call it Arriba was, remember, at that time, you had to get up in the high listings of iTunes, and what better way to do it than to start with an A, right?
Very, that's right, that's right.
But it ended up being great because I love the word Arriba. It basically, it gives the enthusiasm and of folklore and culture. So I have it up on iTunes, and right now I'm just doing lectures from the different regions of Mexico. The first one was a little tidbit and a snippet about Jalisco, the Jarabe Tapatío, and its origins, as well as other regions. The second one was an interview I did when I was in California at the Podcast and Portable Media Expo last year. The day before, I interviewed José Hernández, the director, creator, and the leader of the Mariachi Sol de México, who plays a Cielito Lindo down there in South El Monte in Southern California. And it was, I think that's the better one, because I don't know if you listen to it, but the interview just takes off and goes in the direction that all podcasters love in an interview. And then the third one, I just released the third episode last month, was the one on Veracruz, the Conjunto Jarocho, and especially El Son de la Bamba, its origins and everything else. And of course, every time I hear it, I get the goosebumps. It's in my blood, of course, as a Mexican folklorico dancer.
That's right, folks. And by the way, the music you heard at the very beginning of the show was Ballet Folklorico Estudiante from the Independent School District at an event in San Antonio called Siesta. And it's a week-long event, and Fred was out there, recorded that piece of music. I asked him if we could use it on the show. So I hope you enjoyed that. That's the real thing, folks. We just can't see the dancers. And Fred, let's take it from there in your podcasting career. And obviously, you're a very accomplished professional. But I really want to kind of go back in time now and talk about your story of migration. Because, yes, like me, I think that's where our passion comes from. We're very lucky to be not only be immigrants, but be immigrants in the United States who have had a lot of different trials and tribulations that make us who we are. You are certainly that kind of person by what you sent me. So let's start at the beginning. When you first migrated to the United States, you know, what led to that happening, to you leaving your homeland of Mexico and coming to the U.S.? Let's start off with that basic question.
It was a long time ago. I'm 58 years old. So back in 1949, it was a situation where I had, you know, very hardship traumas with my family. I had a broken family. And so my uncle, who was allowed in as a bracero during World War II, was able to get his residency. And then my mother, who wanted to migrate to the United States, took us to Tijuana. We stayed with very close friends and relatives in Tijuana for several years, and I think it was until 57 that we finally were able to legally get our papers and go across. So I migrated here in 57. My natural language and first language was Espanol, as we all talked, in Tijuana and Baja California. And then I went to school in the United States, finished my primary school, went to high school, and I got a full scholarship to go to Loyola University in Los Angeles. I don't know if I can mention the university, but I went to the university, and unfortunately, before I was able to graduate, I lost the funding that I had for the scholarship, because during the summers, I went to Mexico. I went to La Universidad Jaime Balmes. It doesn't exist anymore, but Jaime Balmes in Guadalajara, and I was able to study the advanced courses in Spanish and Mexican literature, and getting a degree in Spanish, and also taught English to the Mexican professors there at night. During the day, I was teaching composition, conversation, and grammar to the Canadians, the Americans that went there for the summer.
Great. Well, let's stay back in the early or the late 50s, if you will, because it sounds to me, and obviously you've accomplished a lot since then, and we'll definitely talk about some of that. But it sounds to me, first of all, what part of Mexico were you born in? And, you know, so when you came to Tijuana, where were you before?
I was born in the town called Aguascalientes. And as they say, it's el ombligo de la República, the belly button of the Republic, because it's in the geographic center. Poor town. Very agricultural. In those days, it was a small town. Now it's a large city. We emigrated from there to Jalisco. My mother is originally from Tepatitlan, which is in the highlands, Los Altos. And she migrated from there because of the hardships. No jobs, very tough life, agricultural. She only had a third grade education. My father was not available at that time. He had, by the way, my father was in the Revolución Mexicana.
Wow.
He was 12 years old, and if you ever saw the movie, what was it called, The Wild Bunch,
right,
where you had that young messenger boy running from telégrafos, from place to place, giving the orders in a handwritten note, that's what he did. He made his career in telégrafos de México after the Revolución, and then after I was born, I was the last of the sons, and he decided to go his way, and my mother and he separated, so she went with my uncle to get a better life for us, because we absolutely had no money, no future, no nothing. And my uncle, being a bracero, was able to get her in touch with the people so she can apply for for residency. But, you know, and it took us, 6 years to wait in Tijuana. And we went to school there and kind of grew up there, shedding away and shying away from, at that time, which were very violent gangs on both sides of the border in Tijuana, the border town.
So you were waiting for American residency at that point?
Right. We were waiting for our residency to get approved and everything.
Okay.
And finally, when it did, we crossed and we lived with my uncle for that time on until basically he passed away 3 years ago. But my uncle was the one who encouraged us to go and migrate to the U.S. because he had already been here since the World War II as a bracero and worked in a lead refinery. He only had a first grade education, so I had basically my parents and my uncle, whom I lived with, that basically had no real education. But however, they encouraged both me and my brother. There were only two of us siblings. They encouraged us to get educated. So I went to school, worked my way through high school, worked my way through college, doing all the manual chores. Washing floors, cleaning toilets, scrubbing, waiting on tables, doing any kind of gardening and landscaping work, manual labor, digging ditches.
So you were a boy of about 8 or 9 then when you got to the U.S., right?
That's correct. I was almost 8 years old.
What were your impressions like of, what did you think America would be like? I mean, living in Tijuana, you were living, you know, at the footstep of America. You know, Tijuana in the late 50s was a place where people would go, you know, to the carreras, the horse races that were very famous there. Certainly it had a reputation for being a party town even then, although it was very small. But a lot of people, you know, were moving into the, or migrating into the U.S. illegally right through that town at that time. the early immigrants, and of course that increased as time went by. What was it like living there, and then what did you expect to find when you got to the U.S. as a young boy?
Well, Victor, when I lived in Tijuana with our friends that were there, it was basically on the outskirts in the country, what would be called either very semi-rural or rural, and I didn't see the city life. When I went to Tijuana, there would be a lot of crime and violence. I remember a lot of the traumas that people had were seeing people shot in the street through different gunfights that were taking place because of crime. When I went to Tijuana, the city, the few times that we did go, I remember I was always fascinated because of the buses, the transportation, so many people. It was just a hubbub of activity. When I got to the States, the first thing that I really, really got surprised with, toilets with running water instead of outhouses.
Yeah, that would surprise any of us. So were you expecting, I hope you heard my story as I came to the U.S., because we were the same age, basically. And I know I had a lot of, you know, dreams and aspirations and people that would say, you know, this is what it's going to be like, this dreamland, this, you know, and so were you told those same types of things, or were you given more of a realistic view of what life would be like once you arrived at the U.S.?
Our life was a daily struggle, and so we weren't given any expectations at all. As a matter of fact, we didn't know what to expect. My mother was looking for work, and so she didn't want to tell us anything. She said, we're going over here, and we're moving to live. So we really, my brother and I, didn't have any notion of what it was going to be like. We thought it was more or less going to be moving to a place like the city of Tijuana. And when we got to Southern California and lived in downtown L.A., boy, what a surprise.
Wow. Tell me a little bit about that experience of, you know, going from rural, you know, Baja California to the middle of L.A. You know, what were some of the things that happened there that really mold you over? For example, we're talking about late 50s America. Did you experience a lot of racism?
The one thing that, yes, it was, we experienced it. The problem that we had, it's not a problem. What happened was that it was so prevalent where we were always put down. There was prejudice, there was racism, and there was discrimination. But since that's all we knew, we figured and we assumed that this is the way things are naturally. We were too ignorant to realize that a world without racial prejudice and discrimination didn't exist. That was it. It's almost like being born into slavery. You just assume that this is the way it is for you, and you'll never get out of it. However, when we started going to school,
right.
That's when we found out that there was a difference, that people were being treated differently, and so we learned how to deal with it. And my toughest problem, as well as my brother's, was trying to stay out of the gangs in the grammar schools, because they forced you to become one of them. And if not, I still remember, I got, as they say, me dieron mi buen patiza, I got the holy heck beat out of me for not joining them, as did my brother. So we didn't go through the ritual and join them. We wanted to stay away. And so I did everything I could. I became an altar boy, an acolyte in the church. I tried staying away from the gang members as much as possible, and really didn't have a social life. Neither did my brother.
Yeah, I think people don't realize how much pandillas or gangs have been a part of Los Angeles life for a very long time. Not as violent as they are now, and not probably as focused on crime, but you know, my stepfather, who was Mexicano, was raised in Watts when it was primarily Mexican American, and he has some incredible stories about the days of the Zoot Suit and some of the you know, things that happened during that time. And you know, he's dead now, but boy, those were just fascinating times, because there was a true divide, literally two cultures living in one space, or probably three when you consider the Americans, blacks, and then Latinos that were very prevalent in Southern California at that time.
Three cultures, definitely, because we lived right where the downtown area where the Santa Monica Harbor freeways now meet.
Oh, sure.
At that time, there was a delineation that two blocks from where we lived was the black section. So we had our encounters with them. Mm-hmm. I got my nose broken by them when I just went to the store to get some tortillas.
Sure.
And we had fights with them and tried to stay away from them. And then, of course, the Anglo or the whites were the ones that were discriminating against us. So we were caught in the middle between two cultures that that always picked on us and put us down all the time. But we got used to it and just kept out of sight, out of mind. It wasn't until I got to high school that I finally really came into my own and discovered that there is something above racial prejudice and how to deal with
it. So how did you balance out the need to keep your identity as a Mexicano, as a Latino, and the need for assimilation, obviously being in high school, being educated, staying out of trouble? You had aspirations that went beyond the color of your skin or your country of ethnicity. So how did you deal with that assimilation step while not losing yourself in the process?
Well, Spanish was the natural language. For us in those days, we were forced to basically abandon it and become anglicized in language because my mother put me into a Catholic school after she saw what the public schools were like, and it took all her money to do so to put us there. But the nuns used to beat us every time that we spoke Spanish, literally slap us on the wrist with rulers and beat us and push us and shove us and, you know, use a physical punishment, corporal punishment, only because they said that if you speak Spanish, then you're speaking the gang language. And so they quickly, after a couple of years, were able to get that out of you. So for the several years I was there to finish up my primary education, we lost our identity, and we were just trying to grope for anything. There were Mexicanos, and there were Latinos, and there were Chicanos in the classes that my brother and I were in, and we related to them and kind of mingled, as you may say, mingled into a big melting pot of various Latinos. And it wasn't just Mexicanos. I mean, they had Salvadoreños, they had Nicaragüenses, they had Cubanos. And then when I went to high school, it was a very, very well-known high school, 99% white. But because it was a high school that you had to test to get in, mm-hmm. my brother and I were very fortunate. We did well on the test. He got into a high school that was in East Los Angeles, primarily Hispanic and Mexicano. Uh-huh. I was able to get into the downtown high school, private school, where I worked my way as a student worker through it, but 99% white. I found myself on the short end of the stick, but was able to rise above it because I found an identity in success, academic success, as opposed to racial identity.
So we probably are now in your later high school years, and you know, for anybody who is listening that maybe are younger viewers, an event happened in the U.S. that was monumental. The Vietnam War started. Never mind that you were obviously were in Los Angeles when the racial riots of the early 60s happened. And so there had been a lot of evolution happening in this town where you were now a part of society. But now here comes the Vietnam War. You're a Mexican citizen still, I am assuming, but a resident of the U.S. and certainly eligible for the draft. What happens to Fred in this situation here where, you know, let's talk about that because I think it's a fascinating aspect of your story.
Okay. I was in my high school days. The Watts riots were going on in 65. That was my first exposure of the military in the United States because our place was right within the riot area. And, of course, we were under martial law, sealed off, and I saw Jeeps with military armed guards running around. That was my first view of an American soldier. When in high school, I graduated from high school and went to college, the Vietnam War was starting. I saw lots of demonstrations. As a matter of fact, I was taken for the equivalent of a college, what do they call, open house at Berkeley, University of Berkeley, and got caught right in the middle of a demonstration there with Joan Baez. So I saw it from one end where the students were protesting against the war. The next year, I ran out of money to go to college. And because of that, if you remember, you can't register for college at the university, and I was 20, almost 21 at the time. They said, well, we have to tell the draft board. My number on the first lottery was number 29. My brother's number was 327, so he wasn't going to get called because of the lottery system was only going to 192 for those being selected to go to Vietnam. And I was given my notice, went to the draft board, and I started like an ignorant fool. I didn't know anything about the military obligation. So I went up to this big, burly black sergeant who must, to me, looked like he was 10 feet tall and superhuman. Uh-huh. And I said, excuse me, sergeant, there must be some mistake. You see, I'm a Mexican citizen. And I had my papers. I had not only the ones I had from the consulado, which was called the matricula, which happens to be the resident document that you need as a Mexican citizen to prove you're a Mexican citizen when you go to Mexico.
Right.
But I also had my what's called cartilla militar, my Mexican draft card. I was still subject to the Mexican draft and give 2 years of service there. Huh. And so I was going to explain this to the sergeant. All he said was, shut up and sit down, boy, and look at that yellow line and follow it. And, of course, being intimidated, I did exactly what I was told. At the end of the day, almost like a production machine assembly line, they were stamping everybody acceptable, passed. And I asked the sergeant at the end, what does this mean? He says, well, in 10 days, you're going to be drafted, young man.
Wow.
And it was very precise, came in earlier, the induction notice. So here I am.
How long were you in Vietnam?
I was in Vietnam for one tour, which was a year. And I was drafted and as a infantryman.
Vietnam is a story within itself, and we don't have time in this podcast to get to the intricacies of that. But needless to say, the American public in general didn't have a very good feeling about the Vietnam War in period. And when it was over, many American citizens who had fought out there for all of us came back to less than a warm welcome. What did that look like for a Mexican citizen? I'm assuming you were still a Mexican citizen then, you know, because here you were coming back to a country who was not exactly being welcoming to its soldiers.
While I was over there, I noticed one thing in the jungles and the rice paddies of Vietnam is that I'd say 20 to 25% of the combat infantrymen soldiers that were on missions with us were aliens. I'm not talking about just Mexicans. My best friend was one of the Colombianos there.
Yes, yes.
And unfortunately, if you were between 19 and 26 and had just gotten your residency, you were at the top of the list. So I came back from Vietnam, and I was happier than heck to get out. I had survived as a combat infantryman. And by the way, I volunteered to go airborne because that training I knew was going to help me, and it did save my life. So I was a paratrooper in the Army.
And not only airborne, but which airborne? Because they're very famous airborne, right?
The 82nd Airborne Division.
That's right. And that's for all of you, again, my younger listeners, go look up the 82nd Airborne in the internet. There's a very deep history of honor within that organization. So congratulations for serving there.
Well, thank you. General George Patton called the 82nd Airborne Division America's Guard of Honor.
That's right.
But when I came home from Vietnam, I was in my jungle fatigues. We were in the jet. We were coming home. And when someone mentioned when we came to the shores of Alaska on the way to Fort Lewis, Washington, McCord Air Base there in Washington State, someone said, look, the world, which is what we called it. And everybody just for about 10 minutes could not believe it. It was wild ecstasy and just celebration and joy. People got off the plane. I didn't, but the buddy next to me who was sitting there, he literally knelt down and kissed the ground. I can understand why. I probably would have done it too, but I was just waiting to get over there. I was keeping a low profile. After 3 hours, we got processed. They gave me a bundle of money from back pay, gave me a new uniform, Class A uniform, which was a dress uniform, and I was on my way to the airport, took a bus. But as soon as we got to the airport, there were about 70 or 80. This is Seattle, folks, Seattle, Tacoma Airport, and you know Seattle is always kind of liberal, and they had a protest demonstration against the war. Hippies, long hairs, as we used to call them, and they came and they attacked us. They were throwing, at that time, balloons filled with urine and water. They had plastic bags, because remember, there were still paper bags in the stores in those days. They didn't have the plastic bags, but they had plastic bags that were like lunch snack bags filled with dog dung, and they threw that at us. And they had pickets, and they were hitting us over the head and our back with the corners of the pickets. As a matter of fact, I grew a mustache only because they nicked me right across the lip and caused me to bleed, gave me a gash there that has never healed, and that's why I grow a mustache, to kind of cover it. And so I got on, and trying to get off the bus and go to my gate for to catch an airplane home, if it weren't for the SP, the Shore Patrol Navy folks that were there, which is the equivalent of the military police for the Navy, separating the protesters and getting us quickly to the gates. I mean, I didn't have to wait in line or anything. They just quickly got us on board the plane, put us all in first class, separated us. And the stewardess came by and gave me a wet napkin and said, here. And I said, why? She pointed to my lip, and sure enough, it was bleeding. And I had the stench of urine on my uniform from that. That was my welcome home.
And so at that point, I mean, had you become an American citizen during the war?
No, they offered it to me. I would have to process and apply for it on my way, on my return back.
Right.
And of course, somebody is saying, well, I fought for this country. I might as well become a citizen. But when I landed and saw that, it started changing my mind. When I got home and I saw the rejection of an ungrateful American public to the people who fought the war and putting the blame on them and the way we were treated, that is the first time I really felt and internalized what real discrimination and prejudice was. Not racial. This was real discrimination and prejudice from a different... And I, by the way, I consider that a migration, because we were coming back from Vietnam. We had to process in, just like if we were processing in from another country,
which
we did. And so, and we were different. We changed over there, all of us that fought over there, especially the Mexicanos. we changed and we were a different type of person migrating to a new world where it was, we're never going to leave again. We're so grateful to be there because we've gone through some terrible hardships. And then, boom, this welcomed us. It was almost like getting a slap on the face for the people who today probably go through life-endangering situations to cross the border, get across, get a job, and then, boom, find themselves in the middle of a situation where there's prejudice and animosity and discrimination.
Yeah, I think a lot of people don't realize that when people get sent to war, you know, you make a very good point that it is a migration. You have to go very quickly through some of the very same steps that you do when you migrate from one country to another. You're coming into a foreign land, period. What is it going to be like physically, the weather, you know, the actual, you know, just everything. And then there is a cultural assimilation. And in a wartime, this happens very quickly. You get, you know, maybe a few pamphlets that tell you, you know, here's some basics on the morals and the common, you know, what are the taboos of the country. But you have to assimilate quickly. And because in the case of Vietnam, you were fighting the same people, you know, a civil war. So you know, the enemy, you couldn't tell the enemy from not the enemy because they spoke the same language, they looked the same. And so that must have been a very, you were injected into a situation where you had to almost do an instant migration. That's a very interesting kind of immigration tale that obviously has never been told here before.
Right. And then when I immigrated back after that instance, I was sent back to Fort Bragg. And then I got one of the assignments to get out of the field was to be a hometown recruiter for the 82nd Airborne. We had to recruit people specifically for the division. They were trying to put a pilot together to see if the volunteer army would work by recruiting for your own division. So I went and I recruited in Los Angeles and Texas and Florida and Miami. I was there for a couple of years. But one of the things that happened was my mother kept getting hate mail and lots of hate mail, to the point where they were threatening. So I had to leave to go to another place so she would be out of danger. And why? Because the local newspaper there ran an article saying how local resident was heading unit leaders to do recruiting for the Army during the war. And so that is what really left a sour taste in my mouth when they were threatening me and my family and my mother. And we got egged, and we got a little bit of vandalism done on our house because they found out where we lived. I had to leave and go to Florida and do my recruiting there because they needed somebody who spoke Spanish to deal with, of all people, Victor, the Cuban population there, and get them to join the Army, join the Airborne, become a paratrooper and volunteer for the 82nd Airborne Division. But one of the things that happened is when I left Los Angeles, I had this ugly taste and disgust in my mouth saying, you know what, I don't want to become a citizen. If they're going to treat us this way, then perhaps it's not worth it. And so what I did when I finally left the Army 2 years later, I had an opportunity to stay. They wanted me to stay, and I said no. I left the Army, and as soon as I got out, I finished my college, went back and finished my last year of college, and I picked up my bags and baggage, took off, and went permanently, I thought, down to Mexico to study down there and finish my advanced degree. And I did not want to become a citizen. And to this day, I have never pursued becoming a U.S. citizen. I still have my Cartilla Militar, which, by the way, I no longer have to give service. I didn't realize. I was stuck in one time flying to Atlanta from Mexico City on my honeymoon, and I got married. They would not let me board the plane unless I had the yellow slip that says you've served in your Cartilla Militar. It was just a method to get a bribe. But now I realize that Mexico has a treaty with allied nations that say if you served in one of the nations of the allied armies that has a treaty with, it's the same thing as having done military service in Mexico. But I did not choose to ever become a United States citizen based on that, on the experience that I got, the prejudice, discrimination, and everything upon returning from Vietnam. And to this day, I travel on a Mexican passport, and I still have to go and get my permanent resident alien card renewed. And as a matter of fact, next week I have to go down to the consul to renew my Mexican passport. So I am, as they say from Jorge Negrete, yo soy mexicano, más mexicano que el frijol, more Mexican than the bean itself.
That's just fascinating because I've never fought a war, so I can't understand, but I do understand that people who bear arms for a country, whether it's the country of their origin or any other country, have to have an inherent love for humanity and life. Otherwise, they would not be able to do that. And so it's such an irony that you have had to turn the other way and say, I'm going to continue to be Mexicano because the very thing I fought for, the freedom of Americans and the Vietnamese that were fighting for their freedom, was denied. So what an irony that is. And how much you must use that so often in your life experience with your own, with your friends and those who you teach, and even in your podcast, because you're obviously a person of deep concern for humanity. So I find that just absolutely fascinating, because there's just such a contradiction there.
One of the things that may be of interest is 28 years after I came back from the war, I finally started getting over the isolation and everything that the Vietnam veterans were feeling. I've actually gone to the VA, and they treated me very well these last couple of years. 35 years too late, but it's better than nothing. And one of the things I discovered was I really should go back, and so I've joined veterans groups to try and give back to the community, especially scholarship programs, especially visiting veterans that are disabled veterans in the hospitals and things like that. So I belong to a couple of organizations, one of them being the Vietnam Veterans of America. There's a poster that they have that I have on my wall here, and it reminds me every day. It's a poster with all the medals from World War I, II, Korea, Vietnam, the Gulf War, Iraqi Freedom, and Operation in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. And it says, never again will one generation of veterans abandon another. So I take it that I can do some positive good to make sure that those who are going now are going to be respected and honored, regardless of the politics. We have to honor and respect what they are doing and be thankful for their contribution, more for their sacrifice, because anytime you're in uniform, it's a sacrifice. But in combat, it is the ultimate sacrifice that you're laying your life down on the line.
Absolutely. And I think that you're the kind of success immigration story that is the very best kind, where we don't ever have to lose ourselves and our identity as cubanos, mexicanos, chinos. It doesn't matter. We can embrace our culture, embrace our heritage and history, while still very much coexist in our new country, love that country, fight for that country, and help others succeed in that country, again, while not losing that identity. I think that it's a great story. I am very interested in knowing, would you do it all again, or what would you do differently as far as coming to the U.S.? Obviously, you haven't chosen to become a citizen, but would you come to this country as an immigrant again?
Definitely, yes. As a matter of fact, I respect this country. I have since I came back, because I saw what the country was doing. I saw the opportunity we had to either do good or bad. I was placed into a wartime situation, and you know what? The U.S. did not behave as brutally as it could have during that time. So I was taken back with the dichotomy of, it's so easy to get caught up in the hate and the frustration and blame, but I didn't want to blame. And today, I respect the United States as much as possible. I take part in all the veterans' events, respect the flag, and tell everybody that we're living in a country that if I had to do it over again, I'd still come up here, because there is no other country in the world that can measure up to the opportunities they're given, and also now the benefits that the people have today, the immigrants have today, less discrimination and less prejudice than ever before. At least that's through my eyes that I see it. It's nothing like what we had when I came here. And if they have so many opportunities they can take advantage of, the only thing that they need is the desire to go out and make it happen.
That's right, Fred. Hey, why don't you tell in your native language, Spanish, what advice you would give to the Mexicano or the Latino out there today, maybe thinking about migrating to another country? Why don't you tell them that in Spanish?
Si ustedes piensan migrar a otro país, entonces deben de considerar que los Estados Unidos tiene las oportunidades y las ventajas mejores de casi todos los países del mundo. Claro que hay situaciones donde discriminación y prejuicio predominantemente están por todos lados, pero no tanto como antes. Uno tiene la oportunidad que otros en ninguna parte del mundo tienen, oportunidad de sobresalir, de tener trabajo, de crear su familia, y también de tener una tasa de nivel de vivir que no es igual por todo el mundo. Claro, se necesita trabajar duro, pero en ese trabajo tiene los rendimientos y beneficios que uno puede esperar y hacer su vida más o menos aquí. Si piensan migrar, la única sugerencia que les voy a decir es que deben de hacerlo correctamente por la ley. Yo tuve que esperar 8 años para migrar a los Estados Unidos, pero vale la pena. Y cuando uno está aquí legalmente como un residente, puede tomar ventaja, puede aprovecharse todos los beneficios que tiene un residente permanente. Y si quieren la ciudadanía, también les espera, claro, con un poco de tiempo, pero para ustedes, si quieren, puede valer la pena.
That's wonderful, Freddy. Very well articulated. Muchas gracias por ser tan honesto y por su servicio. Thank you for your service. Thank you for being so honest. We have been talking to Freddy Castaneda from Austin, Texas, a proud Mexicano, a proud veteran, a teacher, and yes, even a podcaster, showing the diversity that we have in Immigration Tales and how they all end up, just like podcasting, about passion, about humanity, and about wanting to give back. So, Fred, I really thank you for contacting me and for telling us your story today. I know it takes a certain amount of courage to expose ourselves and do that. Thank you so much, Fred.
My pleasure, and thanks to your listeners for their time. Gracias por su tiempo, por ser oyentes de este podcast. De parte de su seguro servidor, Federico Castañeda, estoy muy agradecido.
Excellent. Bueno, hasta ahora todo el mundo. Este es Víctor Cajal diciéndole, tengan buen día. Have a good day, folks. Bye-bye now.
You have been listening to the Immigration Tales podcast. We are always looking for people just like you to interview or to share their immigration story with our listeners. If you're interested in being a part of the show, please write Victor at immigrationtales@gmail.com.